Chapter 5. Spend Time Alone. Practices. Practice 1. Leave your phone at home. The Alamo Drafthouse Cinema in Austin, Texas, does not allow you to use phones once the movie has begun. This is because light from the phone screen stops audiences enjoying the experience of being at the cinema. Of course, most cinemas politely ask audiences to put away their phones, but the Alamo Drafthouse is really serious about it. Here's what they say on their website. We have zero tolerance for talking or using a cell phone of any kind during films. We'll kick you out. Promise. This rule is interesting because the Alamo Drafthouse is the only cinema which has it. Most cinemas have given up on the idea that people are able to watch a movie without looking at their phones. You can't tell a 22-year-old to turn off their phone, said the head of AMC Cinemas in an interview with Variety magazine. That's not how they live their life. He then explained that the company were thinking about changing their rules and allowing cell phone use in their cinemas. The failed fight against cell phones in cinemas is the result of a bigger change that has taken place over the past 10 years. This bigger change is the way that the cell phone is no longer something that is useful occasionally, but something that we need all the time. There are many different reasons for this. For example, young people worry that if they do not have their phone, even for a short period, they might miss out on something better which they could be doing. Parents worry that if they do not have their phone, their children will not be able to contact them in an emergency. Travelers need suggestions for, and directions to, places to eat. Workers worry that their boss might need them and not be able to contact them. And everyone is secretly afraid of being bored. An interesting thing about all these worries is that we have only started to care about them very recently. People born before 1985 have strong memories of life without cell phones. All the worries in the list above existed before then, but no one worried about them a lot. For example, before I was able to drive, if I needed someone to collect me from school after sports practice, I would use a payphone, one you had to pay for with a coin. Sometimes my parents were home, but sometimes I had to leave a message and hope that they got it. Getting lost and asking for directions was a normal part of driving in a new city. It was not a problem because, as soon as I had learned to drive, I learned how to read maps. In the past, parents did not worry that if they went out at night for dinner or a movie, it would not be easy for the person looking after their children to contact them in an emergency. I do not want to say that the time before cell phones was great. All the situations which I have just described are easier now because of them. But I believe that they are only a bit easier. In most of your life, a cell phone really is not that important, or it makes life only slightly easier. They are useful, but not totally necessary. Some people have written about the experience of living without a cell phone. A lot of these writers explain that life without a cell phone is occasionally annoying, but it is not as bad as you might think. For example, a young woman called Hope King spent more than 4 months without her phone after it was stolen at a clothes store. She could have replaced it straight away, but she decided not to. This was because she thought that not buying another phone was a way to say to the thief, "See, you didn't hurt me." She explained the difficulties of life without a cell phone. For example, she needed to look at maps before she went somewhere new. Also, talking to her family was a bit more difficult. She also had a few bigger problems. One example was when she was in the back of a taxi, late for a meeting with her boss. She had to try to get a signal from a coffee shop on her iPad so that she could send him a message. But for most of the time, her life without a phone was surprisingly easy. So when she had to buy a new phone, because she needed one for her new job, she actually felt a bit nervous about having one again. These examples show that, although many people believe that they need to have a phone all the time, this is not really true. Of course, if we had to live without digital technology all the time, it would be annoying. But if we regularly spend a few hours without it, this is not something that we should worry about. It is important that I persuade you that this is true. This is because spending more time without your phone is exactly what I'm going to ask you to do. In the last chapter, I argued that smartphones are the main cause of solitude deprivation. To avoid this, it is very important for you to regularly spend some time away from your phone. Doing this will help you to recreate the regular periods of solitude which used to be a normal part of life. I advise you to try to spend some time away from your phone most days. This period of time could be a quick morning trip to the shops or a whole evening out. It depends on what makes you feel comfortable. To succeed with this, you need to believe that it is not a major problem to be without your phone. It may not be easy at first to believe this. You might need some practice before you are able to accept that it is true. If this is difficult for you at first, you could bring your phone when you're going somewhere, but then leave it hidden in your car. That way, if there is an emergency, you can get your phone. But it is not with you all the time, so it cannot suddenly destroy your solitude. If you are not driving, but you are out with someone else, you can ask them to take your phone and keep it for you. You will need to explain to them why you are asking them to do this. Again, if you do this, you can get your phone in an emergency, but you do not have it with you all the time. This practice does not mean you have to get rid of your phone. Most of the time, you will have your phone with you. However, the practice should persuade you that you can live a life where you sometimes have your phone with you and sometimes you do not. It is a small change in your behavior which can help you a lot, because it will protect you from solitude deprivation. Practice 2. Take long walks. In 1889, as the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche was becoming famous, he published a short introduction to his philosophy. In his book, Nietzsche wrote that only the thoughts we get while we are walking are valuable. He was speaking from his own personal experience. At the time he wrote this, he was coming to the end of a very successful 10 years when he recovered from illness and wrote some of his greatest books. Before then, Nietzsche had been suffering from bad headaches and other health problems. Because of this, in May 1879, he had to leave his job as a university professor. Later that summer, he moved to a small village in the mountains. In the 10 years between 1879 and 1889, some charities gave him small amounts of money that paid for the place where he lived. Nietzsche also used this money to take the train and travel between the mountains, where he escaped from the summer heat, and the sea, where he escaped from the winter cold. It was during this period, while he was living among some of Europe's most amazing mountain views, that Nietzsche became a serious walker. During his first summer in the mountains, he began to walk for up to 8 hours a day. During these walks, he would think. In the end, he filled 6 small notebooks, which he then used to write a book. Nietzsche is not the only famous person who used walking to help him think. Other examples include the French poet Arthur Rimbaud, who went on many long journeys on foot, and the writer Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau once wrote, "I can only do things while I am walking. The countryside is my office." One person said about Rousseau, "Even looking at a desk and chair was enough to make him feel sick." These famous walkers decided to walk for different reasons. However, these reasons all involve the same benefit of walking. It is a wonderful way of finding solitude. In order to understand this, we need to remember our earlier explanation of solitude as when you are not affected by what other people are saying and doing. Nietzsche believed that the ideas he had while walking were far better than any ideas he could get while he was locked in a library reading other people's books. We should use these historical examples to encourage us to use walking as a way to find solitude. When we do this, we need to take really long walks. I have followed this philosophy for a long time. When I was working at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, my wife and I lived about a mile from the building where I worked, on the other side of the Longfellow Bridge. I made this walk every day, whatever the weather. I would sometimes meet my wife next to the Charles River. If I arrived early, I would read. I now live in Tacoma Park, Maryland, a small town just outside of Washington, D.C. This means that I can no longer make long daily walks by a river. However, one of the reasons I chose to live in this town is that it has lots of sidewalks with trees which give shade. People now talk about me as that odd professor who seems to be always walking up and down the streets of Tacoma Park. I use these walks for different reasons. Often, I am trying to solve a problem at work. Sometimes, I am thinking about a part of my life which needs my attention. Sometimes, I use my walks just to enjoy especially good weather or to visit a place I like. Sometimes, I start to walk because I want to solve a problem, and then I discover that my mind really wants to think about something else. When this happens, I follow what my brain is saying to me. Also, I remind myself how difficult it would be to listen to my brain in this way in my normal, noisy life where I do not have solitude. In short, I would be lost without my walks because they have become one of my best ways of achieving solitude. I believe that you will find similar benefits to me by spending more time alone on your feet. Go for long walks regularly. Try to walk somewhere that looks nice. Walk alone. This does not only mean walk by yourself, but also walk without your phone if possible. If you are wearing earphones or reading text messages or describing your walk on Instagram, you are not really walking. This means that you will not experience the greatest benefits of walking. If you cannot walk without your phone, then put it at the bottom of a backpack. Doing this means that you can use your phone in an emergency, but you cannot easily take it out as soon as you start to feel bored. The hardest part of this walking habit is making the time you need. In my experience, you will need to create time for walking in your diary. It is unlikely that you will find free time to walk unless you do this. So, if you want to do a walk on one of your working days, you will need to put it in your diary a long time before you plan to do it. Walks are a great way to start or end a working day. Or you might need to agree some times for walking in the evenings or on weekends with your family. It also helps if you do not limit your walks to good weather. You can walk on cold days, or when it is snowing, or even during light rain. During my walks at MIT, I learned the value of good rain pants. It is hard work, but there are big rewards. I am much happier and do better work when I am walking regularly. Many others, both in the past and today, enjoy the same benefits that come from the solitude created by regular walking. Practice 3. Write letters to yourself. I have 12 black, pocket-sized notebooks on top of the bookcase in my office at home. The 13th notebook is now in my work bag. I bought my first notebook in the summer of 2004, and I am writing these words in the early fall of 2017, so this means I use about one notebook per year. How I use these notebooks has changed over time. The first thing I wrote was on August 7th, 2004, in the very first notebook I owned. I bought this notebook at the MIT bookstore soon after my arrival there to start my life as a graduate student. So, The first thing I wrote had the title MIT, unsurprisingly. It was a list of some ideas for research projects. The first few things I wrote were mainly about my work. However, in early 2007, I also started to write some general thoughts and ideas about my life. One thing I wrote around this time had the title, Five Things to Focus on This Year. In the fall of 2008, I started to think about my life more deeply and wrote something with the title, Better, which was a plan for both my professional life and my personal life. At the end of this plan, I asked myself, maybe a bit too seriously, to accept only excellence for myself. In December 2008, I wrote what I called The Plan, a list of the things I thought were important in my life. This list included all my relationships with other people, as well as my qualities, how I am and how I behave with other people. I can still remember writing this on my bed in my fourth floor room. I had just got home from visiting a friend whose parent had died, so it suddenly seemed important for me to think about my own life more deeply. After that, I always began each new notebook in the same way. I copied my The Plan list of relationships and qualities from the previous notebook into the first few pages of my new one. My first child was born in late 2012, so it is not surprising that my 2013 notebook is filled with my thoughts and plans for becoming a father. My most recent writing focuses quite a lot on planning the years which lie ahead of me. I think this is because I now have a permanent job as a university professor and am also a working author. I might be two notebooks away from finishing this plan, but I am sure I will get there in the end. My notebooks are not really diaries because I do not write in them every day or regularly. Sometimes I fill dozens of pages in a single week, while at other times many months go by without any new writing. In the year of 2006, when I was working hard as a graduate student and nothing important happened, I wrote nothing at all. These notebooks do different things for me. They give me a way to write a letter to myself when I have to make a difficult decision, or when I am feeling bad, or when I have a great idea. Writing also helps me to organize my thoughts in a clear way. I try to reread my writing regularly, but this is often unnecessary. I usually get all the benefits of writing from the process of writing itself. In Chapter 4, I gave Kethledge and Irwin's definition of solitude. When you are alone with your own thoughts and are not affected by input from other minds. Writing a letter to yourself is an excellent way of achieving this kind of solitude. It frees you from noise from other people, and it also provides you with an excellent way of organizing your thoughts. Of course, I am not the only person who has discovered the value of writing to yourself. U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower used a practice of thinking by writing during all of his working life to help him to make difficult decisions and manage strong opinions. He was not the only leader to do this. President Abraham Lincoln used to record his thoughts on small pieces of paper, which he would put inside his hat to keep them safe. This practice asks you to make time to write a letter to yourself when you have to manage a difficult or uncertain situation. You can do the same as me and use a special notebook for this purpose. Or, like Abraham Lincoln, you can grab a piece of paper whenever you need to. The most important thing is the process of writing. Writing will take you away from all the digital technology which is waiting to distract you, and it will give you a way of understanding whatever important things are happening in your life at the moment. It is a simple practice which is easy to do, but which works amazingly well.